Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. I'm in New York City right now. I've just got to my hotel after a pretty horrendous day of travel. A flight that was supposed to take off at 11 a.m. was delayed until 2 p.m. and it didn't take off until after 3 p.m. And despite the fact I booked with Aer Lingus, I ended up going with a company called... what were they called? Wamos Air. There was a technical problem with the Aer Lingus plane. Wamos Air stepped into the breach. And look, we're here, we're fine, we're safe, we're sound. But it would be fair to say that this is the kind of plane that the fucking Wright brothers would have considered a bit basic. And got to New York, got to JFK after all the delays, after the 7-hour flight, whatever it was. And there was nowhere to park the fucking plane. So we had to sit on the tarmac for over an hour. So it's been a hell of a day. It's 8 o'clock here in New York as I'm recording this, which makes it past, 1 a.m., I think, Irish time. So, yes, to say I'm a bit tired and in need of a beer would be something of an understatement. So that's pretty much what I'm going to do. I thought I was going to have loads of time to do the intro and all the bits and pieces for the podcast that I would normally do. Unfortunately, because of all the delays, I don't. However, there is a podcast. You will have to excuse the production values this week. This is not what I was envisaging. However, I did speak to Philippe Auclair earlier in the week on Wednesday. We talked about tickets. We talked about Arsenal. We did all that. So without further ado, I'm going to play that for you guys. I'm just going to put the music at the end of it. I'm sorry. There's no end bit. There's no goodbye. I just need to get this out and up for you guys. So here it is. Here's this week's Arscast. We will have a preview podcast for you on Patreon, by the way. So join us for that at patreon.com/arsblog. For now, over and out. Happy listening. And I think it is time for a beer. Okay, joining me now on the Arscast, delighted to welcome back Philippe Auclair. Hello, Philippe.
Hello to you.
Can we start by talking about the issue surrounding Arsenal's game against Chelsea, which this week was moved at very late notice from Saturday at 5:30 on the 29th of April to Tuesday, May 2nd at 8 p.m. Now, given the fact that Arsenal are playing Manchester City on Wednesday away from home, there are obvious benefits to the team and the players because it gives them more time to recover. But the game was already rescheduled to this 5:30 p.m. TV slot. People from all around the world and all around the UK, for that matter, have made travel plans and booked hotels and booked flights and all of those things. The explanation we have is that there are issues with policing levels because of the coronation, which is taking place the following weekend. So police apparently are being told to take leave the weekend before. That means that they can't then provide sufficient cover to police this game, even though they said they could do it if the game took place earlier on Saturday, which, you know, you make your own mind up on how credible that sounds. I suppose the question I have is like the wider issue rather than the specifics of this game is, yet again, fans who pay a lot of money to travel, whether they're coming from the north of Scotland, the south of England, North America, all over Europe, wherever it is, are being left out of pocket And beyond being left out of pocket, many of them are now unable to get to a game that might have been their only chance to see Arsenal this season. Could be their first chance to see Arsenal in their whole Arsenal supporting lives. I mean, does there need to be a rethink as to how games are scheduled and maybe a moratorium put on the time frame after which changes cannot be made?
I think this is a dossier that should be put on the table of the football regulator as soon as there is a football regulator in England. Because I'm like you, I'm a bit shocked. I'm personally grateful for it because I couldn't have made the game if it had been on the original scheduled date, and now I will be able to be there. But that's a very, very, very thin silver lining. It's just appalling. As you say, I mean, it's bad enough for the people who live, in Highbury and we'll have to reschedule things. But when you consider the amount of supporters we've got and genuine fans who are making huge efforts to come to a game, knowing how appallingly difficult it is to get tickets and now how appalling the situation is with touting as well, which is one thing we should be talking about at some stage, Andrew. The situation with tickets at the Grove is simply unacceptable.
I mean, we did have a conversation last week with Tim Payton from the Arsenal Supporters Trust about this on the podcast. So it is something we have addressed. But yeah, it is obviously a very, very big issue.
Yeah, it is a huge issue. And the problem is that there is no compensation, no mitigation. I'll take an example because I've literally just received an email from a music venue. I was supposed to go to a concert by Ron Carter, you know, the great jazzer, who was unable to make the first gig. And then we were immediately asked by the venue if we wanted to have a full refund of the tickets or if we wanted to be kept to keep our tickets and go to the next one. But there would be a full refund. Now, maybe not a full refund of our travel expenses, but at least there was a lot of... we were given plenty of time to make up our minds, and then there is mitigation in place. In this particular case, there isn't any. It's not as if the club said, well, you know, because of that, if you can't make it and you had a valid ticket and you've booked a hotel room and a flight or a train journey, and we'll compensate you for that, at least in part, and there's nothing of that kind, and it will never happen, will it? So,
no.
Yes, it's when you look at it, when you think about all the song and dance which has been made about the fantastic support that the home crowd has been giving the team throughout the season, which has been absolutely unbelievable at times, that stinks. This said, it's not an issue which only concerns Arsenal, and you could say that in this particular case, Arsenal have got absolutely nothing to do with it, that it was a decision that was taken by other parties, external to football, and which yet again shows that football fans come very, very low in the list of priorities of people who should be given any attention when decisions of that kind are made. This is part of the general view of football in which fans are commodities. And basically, they're expected to do their job, which is to provide atmosphere and support, and therefore enable the Premier League to sell itself as a vibrant competition and so forth. But then when it comes to when matters comes to a head, you know, we don't care. So television is the first thing, obviously, that will have the broadcasters will have a say in when exactly the games are held. I mean, it's bad. It's not awful. I mean, it's worse in other countries. I mean, you know well about Spanish football.
For and
the
sure,
fact
yeah.
that, you know, that there it is. It's reached a kind of summum in the ridiculous. We're not quite at that stage, but when it comes to that, yeah, I mean, the stadium will be full somehow. It will be. But loads of people will be out of pocket by considerable amounts of money. And there will be no compensation, no mitigation, just a vague apology, which doesn't cost much, really.
No, I mean, the statement from the Met Police said that this was a preventative and proactive measure to help mitigate antisocial behavior and crime associated with later weekend kickoffs. And I think on the one hand, we have to accept the reality that, but like football and football fans, there is a measure of policing required. But at the same time, it always seems to be the case that when something like this happens, when, for example, games were postponed earlier in the season, and the reason given was, well, maybe it wasn't the reason, but it was strongly intimated that football fans could not be trusted to maintain a minute's silence for the passing of the Queen, it seems like the easiest thing to do is point the finger at football fans. There's always going to be a small minority or, blackguards or whatever. You know, that's something we have to acknowledge. But at the same time, the vast majority of football fans will go and support their team and behave perfectly, throughout a season. So I find that part of it quite annoying, that football fans, because of the actions of a very small minority, are all labeled or put in one group as an excuse to implement something like this.
Yep. It's always the same principle, is that the actions of a minority serve as an explanation or a reason, a justification for actually imposing measures which affect absolutely every single one of us. That's unfortunately the way it goes, I would say, particularly in England, but not just in England, but particularly in England. As to the antisocial behavior of fans on a Saturday afternoon or evening, I have to say I'm a little bit confused as to how moving that to an 8 p.m. kickoff on a Tuesday night is going to make it better, because I would think, I mean, most of those problems that there are at football grounds, and to be honest, we don't have many at the Grove, do we, are linked to people who drink too much and maybe do ingest other substances before the games and therefore have a kind of behavior that is simply not acceptable. But how is that going to make it easier? I do not quite understand. 8 p.m. is even later. Some people will be really tanked up as well coming to that game. And okay, it's a London derby against one of our fiercest rivals, but it's not a fixture, despite what people would believe, which has created huge problems in the past.
Sure.
So the argument doesn't stand. And it looks really as if what the fans have to deal with was not even taken into the equation. Because surely if you were trying to take a balanced decision and say, okay, well, this is putting pressure on police forces, but police is saying, well, you know, we could do it. Okay, fine. And on the other hand, you say, well, for fans, what are the consequences? Well, the consequences are, some cases, people will lose a lot of money. People won't be able to see their club. This goes for Chelsea fans, by the way, as well as for Arsenal fans. But that doesn't matter. In a way, fans can be taken out of the equation. It is part, I suppose, of a trend, which is more than a trend, which is a fact, that, again, fans are assets, commodities, chattel, which can be basically be disposed of, be managed whichever way suit whoever takes the decision. And is there a way out of it? As I said, it's a dossier that should be on the regulator's table as soon as there is a regulator.
How soon do you think there will be a regulator?
Well, I have no idea, because the process, we have been told should be a quick one, but when you look at the document in more detail, you realize that there's an awful lot of leeway as to how the clubs will be able to carry on functioning the usual way, that self-regulation and dialogue and interaction will be at the heart of it. It won't be the regulators saying, well, from now on, you can't do that, guys. No, there will be consultation, blah, blah. So you can imagine it's going to take a long time. And, you know, it's exactly the same thing as moving games to a day when you know that there are no trains on that particular line, which happens all the time.
Yeah, for away fans, for example, like you get play. You have to play Newcastle at 8 p.m. on a Monday night, and the last train from Newcastle to London leaves at 7:45.
Yes. Or you know perfectly well, because the Network Rail has announced that there will be works on the line between London and Manchester, or London and Liverpool, or whatever. On that particular day, you know that, but you still put the game on that day, knowing full well that people won't have a means to go there by public transport. I mean, I was looking, I saw the other day on Twitter somebody posting a little leaflet which had been done by Network Rail, or British Rail at the time it was, for an FA Cup game. It might have been between Leicester and Arsenal, actually a replay or something like that.
Right.
It doesn't really matter. But anyway, this was back in the 1970s. And the announcement was that because they had there was a replay between those two clubs, British Rail had decided to add extra services on that particular day to enable football fans to go to the ground.
Crazy.
And not only that, wait a minute. So there were two special trains, which is, you know, to be honest, these trains were a bit lively for those who have ever taken one of those services. But anyway, so British Rail even said, in case this goes to extra time or there's a delay, the train will wait at the station for an extra half hour. This was like 50 years ago, almost 40 years ago. And the price of the ticket return put in today's money was £12. Things have changed a little bit, haven't they?
So privatization.
Yeah. And so which is basically, this is the way a public service should function, because it's a service for the public.
Yeah.
So it's all part, yes, as you say, of this, how would you call it? Fans are falling lower and lower and lower down the food chain, while at the same time, fans are asked more and more and more to you know, in order to support their team, to pay more. I mean, I was talking to a Fulham fan just a few minutes ago who told me that some of their season tickets, the price had almost doubled. And that there were now season tickets at Fulham Football Ground, which were £3,000 a year. Which is
what the fuck?
Yeah, I know, and not in the executive suite, right? So, at times, you know, you just think, well, what can we do? I mean, there is nothing we can do. We're just caught in this spiral of exploitation. And people are only too keen to, well, it's not that they're only too keen, but they don't have much of a choice. And they don't have much of a voice either. You know, I imagine if the same thing had been decided in Germany, I think actually the same thing would not have been decided in Germany. I don't think it would have happened, because the reaction would have been so brutal from the fan organizations, and also because they have some say in the way the football is run in their country. I don't think we would have this happening. So it's basically, yes, fans are pushed further and further and further to the periphery. And as a result, we see that a game which is now postponed to 8 p.m. On a weekday. Thank you very much, guys.
Yeah,
really appreciate
you. Yeah, I mean, you think of people, I know that it's a case of caveat emptor and all the rest, but when you do buy tickets from some of these sites, I know there'll be people out there who don't have any sympathy for somebody who buys a ticket via one of these third-party websites, whatever it might be. They overpay because that's the only way they can get a ticket. It doesn't mean they're not genuine fans. It doesn't mean that their loss should be written off either. That's part of the conversation that we had with Tim last week about tickets, about touts, about these third-party websites. Just really, again, to stress to people to be really careful, because, you know, even if you get your ticket in the end, something like this could happen. It could completely mess up your trip. Look, I'm sure this won't be the last conversation that we're going to have about the way fans are treated. So we'll see what happens. And I feel sorry for anybody who has their flights, accommodation, all the rest for the Chelsea game, and now is, you know, troubled or can't go to that that newly arranged date. I do want to move on, though. I want to talk about Arsenal and where we are, and things, you know, since we last talked have been pretty good. They've been going well. Obviously, there is a game that that took place at Anfield, a 2-2 draw, one which left Arsenal fans with mixed emotions, given the fact we were 2-0 up, given the fact that Aaron Ramsdale was the hero right at the end. How do you, now that the dust has settled a little bit, how do you assess a game like that against Liverpool? Do you have to view it in the same way as, you know the way they say with a derby, the North London derby, form goes out the window, all that kind of stuff? You know, given the history of this fixture and the amount of late goals that there have been at Anfield down the years, is it a game that you kind of have to just put in a box on its own and look at as a kind of one-off? Or is it maybe just a case that when you're 2-0 up against Liverpool, you need to be better or smarter? Or how do you view it now after a few days of coming to terms with what we saw?
Well, I haven't really come to terms with it, is my honest answer.
Okay.
Is that I think one way of looking at it is that I think sometimes we spend far too much time trying to make sense of what happens on the football pitch. I think an awful lot of things happen that we do not have any control over, that the players themselves maybe do not even have control over. And that I would say, for once, I completely agree with what Roy Keane said after the game. And when he was asked about, the question was not exactly about that game, but it was about, what did it take to win the treble? You know, they were talking obviously about Manchester City in comparison to Arsenal. The question was put with Gary Neville, but Roy Keane interrupted and he said, luck. And I thought, yeah, absolutely. That's great to hear it for once, that, yeah, it's luck. And yes, I would be tempted to put that game in a box like I would put most games in a box. They all have their own logic or absence of logic. They're all flowing. I mean, they are never set in stone. The fact is that we consider them after the event. We've got result bias, obviously. We kind of apply teleology, to use a philosophical term, the backwards side, thinking, oh, it ended that way, so it was always meant to end that way, which is completely the wrong way to look at football. It doesn't work like that. It's something that that particular game, to me, I still haven't made complete sense of it, because I don't think you can make complete sense of it. I've written a column for Eurosport about the completely ridiculous things which have been said about Granit Xhaka and the impact that the fact that he lost his rag a bit after Trent Alexander-Arnold had lost his, to be absolutely honest, which, of course, nobody is pointing out, it was in somehow the moment, the defining moment. We have absolutely no idea of that. Absolutely no idea. Maybe Liverpool would have reacted anyway. Maybe they wouldn't. I don't know. I can't tell you. It didn't happen. What happens if Gabby Martinelli finds Bukayo Saka with the last chance, the last chance of the game, and we win 3-2. And then nobody would be talking about Granit Xhaka. Nobody would be talking about the great reaction by Liverpool. Or they would talk about it, but it would say Arsenal found the resources yet again late in the game. Nearly did. It was just a matter of inches, as are all these games. So the one thing that I'm worried about this game is certainly not the result or the performance. I thought the performance was, by and large, actually pretty damn good. And yes, we were under the cosh, and you've already talked about that. But for once, Arteta's changes didn't really necessarily make sense, for once. But it can happen. Happens to the best. Mm-hmm. But it's more the impact that it can have on the team as a whole if they really see that as being 2 points dropped, but in a negative way.
I mean, Aaron Ramsdale was on Sky afterwards, and, you know, I watched his interview and I watched Mikel Arteta come on afterwards, and Arteta was, you know, he's very careful with what he says, but he's also a guy who kind of wears his heart on his sleeve. So you know what sort of a mood he's in when he's talking to the press, whether it's post-game or pre-game or whatever it is. You know, you can tell. He was really upbeat about the way Arsenal played in the first half, and he talked about how nobody had done that. And Ramsdale was saying the manager is, you know, in the dressing room talking about the positives of this. I mean, I would have had a real worry going into these last eight games if, having been 2-0 up at Anfield, we had lost and one of those late chances went in and you have that kind of soul-crushing defeat.
Yeah.
You know, the conceding a late goal to lose a game there is rarely a worse feeling in football, as we know. We've been there, we've experienced it. Everybody, I think, has experienced that in their lives as a football fan, as an Arsenal fan, or otherwise. So I do wonder if, you know, that message of positivity that exists within the dressing room is, you know, is part of the way Arteta is managing the squad. You know, the one game at a time. Okay, we didn't win this game against Liverpool. We were 2-0 up, but look at what we still did. And we had what it, you know, in the end, as hair-raising as it was, you know, what's the equivalent to a goalkeeper pulling off a string of saves? Is it the same as a striker in the last 5 minutes banging in a couple of goals? It might be.
Yeah, you know? It might be. And we've taken 22 points out of a possible 24 since the defeat to Manchester City.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's the problem, guys? I mean, it's ridiculous. And which is also part of the equation is the fact that, you know, running behind us at the moment is a team that looks pretty unstoppable. And every time it sets on the pitch, which again was the case yesterday when they played against Bayern, even though Bayern were quite threatening at times, but it felt at one point where the machine started to get its act together, it was fairly impressive. So they're setting a standard in terms of results and points that is almost unheard of in the history of the game in England, which is one thing we also tend to forget. What is happening is not normal. In any normal season, the title should be ours. And because we're so far better than anybody else, apart from the other guys. So, which again, you know, it's a question of perception, is how you change the perception that the players themselves have had of it. You could say actually that they're a huge disappointment at the end, despite the fact that you know, they were pummeled in the last few minutes, shows that the disappointment was the fact that they really believed they should have won that. And that, in effect, was the kind of disappointment that you're happy with. They were not banging their fists, you know, thinking, at least we saved the point. So this is how high their ambition, how high their aim is, how big their ambition is. So that's not too bad. But the other thing is that I'm a little bit surprised that people, most people anyway, when we look at the run-in and compare the run-ins, and everybody's pointing at the game on 26th of April and obviously at Manchester City, I genuinely don't think this is going to be decided there. What's going to happen is that either Manchester City or Arsenal or both are going to drop a silly point or silly 2 points or three at a place that you don't expect, exactly like Manchester City dropped 2 points against Nottingham Forest after having absolutely slaughtered them for the whole game. And then literally, within the last few seconds, they grabbed an equaliser. Who could have seen that coming? I mean, I have a funny feeling that, in a way, our friends from Brighton are going to play a big role in that, a very big role in that, because they're chasing a European place as well. They're a really tough side, and they're exactly the kind of side that can cause problems to Manchester City, the way they play.
And
they could also be blown apart, by the way.
Yeah.
And they will be playing at home and so forth. So I can't see. I mean, it's completely possible that we have problems at West Ham. They're struggling as well. They're fighting for their survival. But it might be that, unbelievably, Leicester, who are also fighting for their survival, are able to take a point from City this weekend. I mean, it's we have the way we reduce, in a way, what's happening in the league to what is happening between the big clubs when they meet each other is very strange, especially in a situation where we're still 6 points ahead. Has everybody forgotten about that?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, clearly everybody understands, you know, I think Arsenal fans obviously understand what it is going to take to beat Manchester City to this title. Because as you say, I've seen a lot of people talk about, not Arsenal fans, but I've seen a lot of commentary, and I know a lot of commentary out there is sort of designed to generate engagement and clicks and all that kind of stuff. But the idea that, you know, if Arsenal don't win the title, it's somehow a bottle job, that somehow we've thrown it away.
Sure.
I mean, you know, you touched on it there, but I did want to ask you about this, that, you know, what's happened in the Premier League in recent years because of what Man City have built in the way that they have built it, is that in order to win the title, you need to be practically perfect from the first game of the season through to the last game of the season.
Yep.
And I think we've come pretty close so far this season to being that, which is huge credit to the players and the manager and everything else. But at the same time, it is an unrealistic sporting bar, if you like. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
For the bar to be set that high is, as you say, unrealistic. It's not normal in any in any legitimate, healthy sporting competition for that to be the case.
Yes, but that's the way European football has turned. It was thus with, to beat Bayern in the Bundesliga, even if they've had their own problems this season, you have to be near perfect as well. And the fact is, nobody has been near perfect enough for the last, 10 years there?
Yeah.
To break into the top two in Spain is the same thing. At one point, it was the same when Juventus was working, also an interesting system in terms of the finances, but it was the same. In France, obviously, this PSG is that no matter how hard they try to fuck it up, they don't fuck it up in the end, or very, very rarely. I mean, it's happened in France. Lille managed to do it, Montpellier managed to do it, but that in itself was seen as a miracle. And if you, in a league as well, which is supposed to be the most competitive in the world, I mean, what a joke, that you think that you need 100 or something between 95 and 100 points to win the title, that's insane.
Yeah.
That's absolutely insane. It's never happened. The great Liverpool side of the 1970s and 1980s didn't get that kind of points. The great Real Madrid of when they were winning everything in Europe, you know, with Di Stefano, Puskas, Coppa, Gento, and all the others, they were not winning the league by the equivalent of 20 points ahead of the competition. It didn't happen. And it was considered normal that there would be setbacks. And I'm not even sure that what happened at Liverpool, who, we shouldn't forget, beat Manchester City at home 1-0, completely atomized Manchester United, and have actually the third best home record, I believe, behind Man City and Arsenal in the league this season. The fact that we take a point from there and that we've taken 4 points out of six out of a team which at this stage last year was going for an unprecedented quadruple.
Mm.
I mean, we have to take all this into consideration. And I'm sure, by the way, these are also things that Arteta, his staff and his players will be talking about, saying, guys, you know, we can only do what we can do. The other chaps up in Manchester, they'll do what they have to do and so forth. If we carry on, we'll win this.
Mm.
It's just as simple as that. If we take 1 point at Manchester City, that's enough. We could even lose at Manchester City and carry on and win the title. And it should be normal. It should be the way. And the fact that it can be presented as it's a bottling job or whatever is insane. It's absolutely insane. But unfortunately, it's the way some people like to present it, because against I often bore people to death about this, but it's the tyranny of the narrative.
Yeah.
And there has to be a narrative somewhere, even when the narrative is chaos. And most narratives in football are chaos narratives. It's confusion. It makes no sense. I mean, does it make sense that we beat Bournemouth 3-2, in March, with Reece Nelson scoring that glorious goal in the 98th minute? Of course it doesn't make sense. Did it show that we were the best team in the league? It didn't. Of course not. It just happened. And it just showed that this team has so much belief in itself and such talent and such momentum that they were able somehow to pull out, you know, the rabbit from the hat. And other days, the rabbit stays in the hat. In other days, there's no rabbit in the hat whatsoever to be pulled out. let's just enjoy the ride. It's thrilling. I mean, we're living, that's the thing we have to remind ourselves, we're living at the moment one of the most thrilling seasons that I think any of us has actually ever lived. Supporting that club. And that is priceless. We're having more fun than the Man City guys.
I hope so. I hope we have more
we
fun.
Are. Yeah, we are, because they're so entitled and so smart.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, that for them, it's normal. You know, it's that they're disappointed if Erling Haaland doesn't score 7 goals in a game, I think. It's gone to that stage. And they're very good. I mean, it's not to disparage them. Whatever we think of the model, and I think everybody who listens to this will know what we think of the model and the way it's run, and that maybe at some point there will be a comeuppance for that, but we don't know. We can't say. But they are a phenomenal team. And the fact that we are ahead of them at the moment, well, what can I say? Well done, guys.
I mean, you talked about hoping that someone like Leicester might take points off Man City. You know, it is...
Yeah, that might be actually helping
sure.
beyond hope.
I know. Look, I think, you know, we know that it's possible. You know, in football, anything is possible. But we also know it's unlikely. And I did want to ask you about some comments that Mikel Arteta made about the Premier League.
Yeah.
And whether it's the most competitive that there's if this is the most competitive Premier League. And he said, for me, I've been in this league 21 years. I've never seen anything like this. He said, because of the level of the managers, the level of organization, quality of teams, the individual quality of players, the capacity to change teams and players and formations. It's something nobody has seen before. And I do think that's interesting as we hold out hope that one of these teams that, you know, on paper can't or shouldn't be able to take points off Manchester City will do exactly that while we don't allow that to happen to us. But do you think that this strength of the Premier League in that, like, there's no easy games, anyone can beat anyone, et cetera, but is that more evident this season in the bottom half of the table rather than the top half, given how tight it is down at the bottom? How many teams are still in this relegation fight, if you want to call it that? It does look a bit difficult for Southampton now. They're a little bit adjourned, but teams like Everton, like Forest, like Leicester, like West Ham, like Wolves, you know, they're all down there. All of these teams have incredible players, an incredible array of talent, you know, but because of how competitive this league is, they're being sucked into this relegation battle.
Yeah, and what has changed, I think, the most is the fact that it used to be the case that teams that were promoted, for example, from the Championship, were immediately put as favourites for relegation the season after that. I'm not necessarily just talking about the Premier League era, but it's quite logical, you know. But the way it works these days is quite different. I mean, look at the teams which at the moment are going to be promoted directly from the Championship. We've got Burnley and probably Sheffield United, right?
Yeah.
So you have two teams which, in fact, have been Premier League regulars over the past few seasons and who have been able to maintain their financial superiority at the lower level to keep hold of some of their players as well, which they didn't used to be able to in the past. So therefore, the border is blurred up to a point. It's blurred. And instead of having four or five teams fighting against relegation, you will have 8 or 9. And the mid-table has become a dangerous place to be in. I exaggerate when I say that. But look at Fulham, for example. At one point, we were all thinking, oh, they're going for a place in Europe. The way they're working is fantastic. At the moment, the wheels seems to have, well, they're a bit wobbly, aren't they?
Yeah.
And again, talking to my Fulham friend this morning, he was saying, you know, I'm not absolutely convinced that we're out of the fight against the relegation. And of course, it's the paranoia of the football fans.
Sure,
it's quite logical.
They've
got 39 points and teams have been relegated with 42. We know that. It's very, very unlikely because there are so many behind them who are worse, in fact, than they are.
Yeah.
But the frame of mind has changed. And there is now this... the competition, yes, is absolutely fierce.
Is that a good thing? Do you think it's a good thing for the Premier League?
I think the best thing would be if that was the case at the top rather than the case at the bottom. I mean, we all like a relegation scrap. I mean, seen from the outside,
sure,
we enjoy that. But the fact is that there is now, whichever way we look at it, and since Leicester won the title, and it was a miracle in a very, very strange year when nobody was quite working or right. And maybe we missed the trick that season, by the way, ourselves. But since then, it's been pretty much two teams, right? I mean, three, because Chelsea doing what Chelsea does, up, down from one season to the next. But it's been Manchester City and Liverpool. Mm. And they're so far ahead of the rest. And, you know, we're with them. We can expect that from next year onwards, unbelievably and to be, and for me, unforgivably, Newcastle United is going to be allowed to carry on progressing and improving, getting better players, spending more hundreds of millions to get where they want to be. And then we have also the prospect of Manchester United doing exactly the same thing, if indeed, as we are told, even though there's a third round of bidding, the Qataris are in pole position to take it. Well, we know exactly what's going to happen. So the whole thing of the competitiveness, it's actually quite revealing that every time we've got a game like this, Liverpool-Arsenal, which, by the way, we don't have very often, it was an astonishing and a fabulous game. And commentators, analysts, and people who try to sell the Premier League have every time to tell us, this is what Premier League is all about. Well, no, not necessarily. The Premier League can also be about a crap nil-nil between, I don't know, Tottenham and Brentford. I think Brentford are exciting to watch, but
yeah,
Tottenham
know,
and Bournemouth. It can be, you know, it can be anything. The Premier League is also that. Actually, most of the Premier League is actually not that thrilling. The results, you know, can be a bit surprising at times, but the idea that it is a super competitive league in which there are no easy games is wrong. All the games are tough, and I think that we're also victim of another misperception. Is because it is true that the level, the technical level, tactical level, and physical level is very, very high. That is true, and it's probably when you look at leagues in the as a whole, it is the on this level, yes, it is better and ahead of other leagues, but the level of engagement, the speed of the game makes us think that it is more competitive than it actually is, if you see what I mean.
Mm.
We get lost a bit in the chaos of it because it goes very fast, because it's crash, bam, wallop, all these sort of things. And then we think, oh, that's competitive. No, it's not competitive. It's just the teams are competing, yes, doesn't mean that they're competitive. There's a big difference between the two. You know, how many, I haven't got the table in front of me, but I should have a look, actually. I should put the table in front of me. I mean, that should take me long. Because at this stage of the season, I think it is quite unusual that we have, I'm looking at the bottom here. Okay. Thank you. Oh, dear. My computer is going mad. Well, maybe you've got the table in front
have.
Of you.
I have.
And okay, sorry. Oh, here we go. Right, Southampton, who've been absolutely crap, still have 23 points. You know, they're not Derby County of the good old days.
Yeah.
They're supposed to be the worst of the worst, and they've been pretty bad. But they might end up the season with more than 30 points, and so we've got 8 points between 13th and 20th place. That's nothing. That's absolutely nothing.
Mm.
And I can't remember from in life of me of a season like that. And the differentials are absolutely, I mean, colossal. I mean, we are now 20 points ahead of Tottenham, who are fifth. That's crazy.
Huge, isn't it?
Yeah, we're 17 points ahead of Manchester United. I mean, we could carry on like that. It's crazy. But again, it follows the template of what recent seasons have been, as in some teams dominate, hegemonous fashion. The league, it just happens this year, there are two teams that you wouldn't have expected to be in this top four, which is Newcastle United in third position at the moment, and ourselves at the top.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have expected that. But apart from that, there are some patterns which are repeated and which have to do with tactical excellence, yes, and all that, but especially with spending. So I think that what we're looking at is the only thing that I'm crossing everything, I'm not absolutely sure that we can replicate this kind of season. That's the only thing that, that bothers me or worries me a little bit. But when I look at it and I'm thinking, don't worry about it, just be happy about what we're witnessing. You know, don't project yourself in the future. There's absolutely no point in that.
Well, yeah, we've got enough to worry about between now and the end of this season without starting to worry about next season already. So the final thing I just wanted to talk to you about very quickly was the fact now that with Gabriel Jesus back, we have a striker who has returned from injury after a long scoring drought before injuries, now got 3 goals in his last 4 games, or in the 4 games since he returned. And it gives Mikel Arteta a conundrum at times, but I'm sure one that he will absolutely relish, given that he's got Gabriel Martinelli, he's got Bukayo Saka, he's got Leandro Trossard. He has a 4-3 situation, assuming that these guys can stay fit, you know, for the remaining 8 games. Is that the biggest possible positive that Arsenal can take into these final fixtures? Is the fact that they have players who can contribute and have contributed and who are able to contribute big goals in big games without us wondering where are these goals going to come from? And that's not even taking into account, you know, Granit Xhaka, who scored a lot this season, Martin Odegaard, who scored a lot from midfield. And I do think there's a conversation to be had about those goals from midfield and how important they are, you know, to a team in a season like this. But just to sort of round this off, this front four that he has got, finding the balance or finding the combinations for the specific games feels like this could be the key to success in the fixtures that we have coming up.
I agree with you entirely. And I would add also, I have to say, I would add Emile Smith-Rowe to the equation. You never know. He might have a big contribution to make at some point, just like Reece Nelson made one against Bournemouth. So There are solutions there, and there are ways to actually chop and change. And you know, of course, you can deploy Leandro Trossard as a shadow nine or a fake nine. He offers something very different. I have to say, I absolutely love everything he does when he comes on the pitch. He has an instant impact on what he does, and it is different. He's a different kind of player to Bukayo Saka, for example.
Sure,
and Gabriel Martinelli as well. The thing is that these players also are players who can play at a number of positions. You can imagine Gabriel Martinelli playing down the middle. There's absolutely no problem. You can imagine Trossard playing at every single spot across the front three. And I would put it against Bukayo Saka to be able to do that as well, if he were asked to. I think he's talented enough for that. Whereas Gabriel Jesus can also play as a winger. You know, you've got all these situations. And the reason why we are here is because we've scored 72 goals in 30 games. Now, I don't know how good your numbers are on this, but how long is it since we've been scoring at something like, it's quite crazy, 2.4 goals a game?
Wow. Last season we scored 61 goals in 38 games. So, you know, that's not anywhere close to that.
I'm thinking even if you're going back to the glorious Wenger years, I think, I can't remember how many goals was the maximum, but I would imagine that we're going to go beyond that, no?
I'll have a look at the Invincible season here. We scored, amazingly, in the Invincible season, we scored 73 goals in 38 games.
I was going to say 74, yeah. But
wow.
We had a yeah, I know.
Holy, I mean, that's crazy.
I think that gives the right perspective as to what we're doing at the moment. And when we're looking at the players we had going forward in attack in that great team, we had some of the greatest players in the history, not just of Arsenal Football Club, but of the English League, and you could say of European football.
Wow.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was pointing at. I was going to say 74 is 73, It's remarkable. So, yes, I agree with you entirely. This is what the success is going to be built on, because there are going to be a few shaky moments at the back. We know that we're still not quite absolutely watertight. I mean, sorry, you hear my sigh. It's because I've heard people criticizing Zinchenko, and I just sometimes, you know, I'm not a violent person at all, but there are moments like in virtual terms, I think, you know, could you just shut up because you were nutmegged? That's it. You're the worst left back we ever had in the history of the club. And I just, it makes me so angry, this kind of nonsense. But it's true that we do take risks, that, you know, we sometimes we're a bit exposed. It's true that,
it's risk reward, isn't it? And for most of the season, it's been more reward than risk. But
and
you're going to get caught out from time to time.
Have been successful in this league recently. I mean, the two most successful teams in this league have been Liverpool and Manchester City. Both of them are teams which actually do take quite large risks in the way they play. Even Manchester City.
Liverpool too.
Yeah. Sorry.
I mean, I was going to say, I think Tim Stillman, I heard him talk about this, where basically, I think he said, Alisson is the goalkeeper who saved the most one-on-one situations. And that tells you, and this is with a defence with Van Dijk that's been held together, you know. So there is an element of, you know, you count on the quality of the players you have back there to bail you out when those situations arise.
Exactly. The same way that we can thank Aaron Ramsdale for an absolutely magnificent performance, which, by the way, he found himself, I don't know, it's just crossed my mind, he found himself in those last few minutes in the same situation he used to find himself in the teams that he played for before. He's used to that.
Yeah,
he's used to mayhem in the box because he was the last rampart of defence in teams that were
relegated,
down for relegation, and which were pummeled shot after shot after shot. And he relishes that. It's obvious he absolutely loves it, and he's totally in his element. So, everybody will have to play their part. But obviously it's upfront that we're looking for the solutions. Carry on scoring as many goals as we are, and we should be fine.
Well, let's leave it to that front four to do the business. And fingers crossed they can do that. We leave it there for now, Philippe, as ever. Great to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.